Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for April 24th, 2022. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks. You can find me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks. And you can find my column, full-page column, each week in the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter, either hard copy if you're like me and you like to read it, you like to have it in your hands and read it, or if you're one of those who like to get it online as soon as it comes out, you can find it in PDF form on pwtorch.com if you are a VIP member. If you're not, pwtorch.com/govip, and you can get all the details about what comes with a VIP membership. Tonight here on Wrestling Night in America, where, as always, we talk about the big shows in pro wrestling, we're going to talk about some big shows in pro wrestling. Impact held a pay-per-view last night, Rebellion. Last week, New Japan's Windy City Riot took place in Chicago. And we've also got a show coming up in 2 weeks, big WWE pay-per-view, WrestleMania Backlash. So we'll talk about those and other shows and anything you want to talk about, because you are a big part of the show. You can call in and talk with us, 515-605-9345. If you can't listen live, you can email us anytime, wnialivecast@gmail.com, and we will get to your emails on the show. So last night I mentioned Impact Rebellion took place. We had Steve Maclin over Chris Sabin and Jay White. Taya Valkyrie defeated Deonna Purrazzo to win the AAA Reina de Reyes title. Ace Austin won the X Division title, defeating Trey Miguel and Mike Bailey in a triple threat. Tomohiro Ishii defeated Jonah. In a tag team title gauntlet match, EY and Joe Doring, the last two entrants in the match, retained their Impact tag titles. Tasha Steele defeated Rosemary to retain the Knockouts title. Josh Alexander defeated Moose to win the Impact title. So to talk about this and all the other big stuff we've got going on, I welcome PWTorch.com contributor Tyler Sage. Tyler, welcome back to Wrestling Night in America. Good to have you.
Hey, always good to be here. Thanks for having me on, Greg. Very excited as to the top. A lot going on in wrestling post-WrestleMania season, as is always the case. But excited to be here to talk about it and to talk with you in the audience.
Now, I usually wait until the end of the show for plugs, but Tyler, you have played a big role in PWTorch.com's relaunch of our YouTube page. So I want you to take a few moments at the start here, talk a little bit about that and what role you've played in that relaunch.
Yeah, I appreciate you doing that. If anyone listening hasn't noticed, we have relaunched the PW Torch YouTube page. Just search PW Torch and you will find us. Please subscribe. Always super helpful. But yeah, you know, this is something that Wade, Zach, and myself have kind of been mulling over for a while now. And you know, podcasting alone is difficult to do on a regular schedule. I think you could attest to that, Greg, to do a show basically every Sunday in perpetuity is not easy on your actual life, I would assume. So it's a labor of love for all of us. But this is an addition, and just thought there would be some, you know, different aspects of our personalities that we get out there on video and different format, especially, you know, we're testing right now, not doing it from a VIP standpoint, just to do content out there. And yeah, it's been exciting at this point. You know, it's going to change a lot. We're going to add a lot of great shows once we get our bearing under us here. But yeah, it's been fantastic. It's, you know, been mainly a place for Zach and I to have a conversation show every week, and then some daily news hits, but that will definitely expand, and we appreciate feedback and comments by everybody listening. If you haven't checked it out yet, please do so. But yeah, it's been a labor of love, as I said at the top, and it's been a lot of fun, a learning exercise for me as well. So hopefully you, as a member of the community, see that production values get better and better as we go along here. We appreciate you sticking with us and checking us out. So yeah, thanks.
It's not easy to do a podcast and put yourself out there and put your opinions out there. But to then do that and then put a face to that is also very difficult. I applaud you and Zach and Wade because you guys have the look to do video, whereas I have a face for radio, so I'm sticking behind my microphone here on Wrestling Night in America and just letting my voice speak for itself. I've done a couple for those who haven't seen. I've done a couple, not Torch related, but I've done a couple video interviews before. And you know, if you think you know it's anxiety ridden doing just a podcast, making sure you pronounce everything right and making sure you have your facts right and making sure that you know you're not saying anything stupid, and then you know, and then add the additional anxiety of, oh, by the way, now your face is out there and every twitch and every scratch and every itch you have is going to be recorded as well. Not easy. Not easy. I can attest to that. So, yeah, that's a wonderful addition to the Torch lineup. And Tyler, I'm glad to see your role expanding here with the Torch too. I think that's really cool. I think you have a lot to offer. So, really happy to see that, but, we'll plug a little more later on. But that's, I think we're good for now. So I listed the results for Rebellion, and Josh Alexander now back on top as the Impact champion. He had won the title very briefly at the last pay-per-view. Moose came out and ended up getting the victory soon after, and I didn't really like that booking decision. I don't know that Josh Alexander right now is better off than he was back then. You know, if you could make the argument that, well, you know, the chase will make him stronger for when he does eventually win the title, then I might buy that. But we've now lived through that, and I don't know if we can say that. But I think we can say pretty safely this was the time now to put the title on Josh Alexander.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. I also agree with you on the booking decision there. I mean, not that it feels like Tommy Dreamer in ECW, you know, when he finally won it, and then I can't remember who came out and actually beat him like immediately after he won it, but it wasn't exactly that. But it's pretty darn close for someone that, you know, had that long story to get there. And this to me felt more like a, you know, hey, that was probably not the right decision, and then also, you know, Josh is the guy. So if you kind of take that speed bump out of it, I really enjoyed the story of Josh. You know, I mean, just even the stuff not on the screen with him, you know, not having a contract, his visa getting, you know, needing a new visa, and then getting all that together and coming out and being the champion of the company. It's been really a great story with an Impact. And, you know, I don't know how broadly, you know, we want to go here. I don't want to go off Josh immediately, but I think the show showed that, you know, a company like Impact that is obviously, you know, probably the number three company in North America right now, has done a pretty good job making its world title seem very important. And, you know, its tag team wrestling and its women's division are something to respect from a booking and talent decision standpoint. And, yeah, I think both AEW and WWE can learn a lot from, you know, minus the booking decision that you talked at the top, but just how to kind of formulate and make a good show with a roster that is super talented. So, yeah, I enjoyed the show a lot. So, kind of away from your initial subject there, but I think Josh Alexander is a good champion, and the story has been really, really strong, and I'm excited to see where it goes. And I think Impact's in a really good spot. You know, I think it's been on a good trajectory for the past, you know, 6 months or so, but I really think more eyeballs will pop on the product here if it continues on this trajectory.
Well, you mentioned the Knockouts, and it was interesting to see, you know, Tasha Steelz retains the Knockouts title, Taya Valkyrie coming back from her stopover in NXT, I guess you could call it, and winning the AAA Reina de Reyes title. Of course, she spent some time previously in Mexico, so she's no stranger to that environment and winning the AAA title. But how do you see, you know, Deonna Purrazzo, probably the biggest women's star right now in Impact, and Tasha Steelz, the Knockouts champion. They're both heels. Do you see Deonna Purrazzo going back after the Knockouts title? Does she turn babyface? Do they do a heel versus heel thing? Do they just keep them apart? Because I certainly love what Tasha Steelz has done from a character point of view, but it does feel like eventually, you know, with Purrazzo being the biggest star, you would think that she would have to go over the Knockouts title sooner rather than later, unless Tasha Steelz just doesn't hold it long enough for her to have a chance to do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. thought there. I mean, I would say that they don't meet in the near future, but, you know, with the Slammiversary show that was announced, what, last night on the show, you know, it's the 20th anniversary, essentially, of the company. And that seems like a pretty big spot where you want to have one of the bigger matches, you know, for the world title, for the knockout title, for the tag team title. So I would say usually they would hold off on that, but I actually think that your initial take there, or option, I should say, not your take, of Deonna going babyface at some point here to challenge for that title makes the most sense, because that's one of the bigger matches they can put on in the division. So we'll see. It just feels like, you know, I am by no way, shape, or form the world's preeminent expert on Impact, but I know that show's important, and how much, especially with the disappearance of ROH the way it was, Impact now kind of holds that torch, if pun intended there, for the show here, of being that one company that made it through. So I think they're going to really lean into the, you know, the history and the importance and the gravitas of that event. So I that's the way I would see it going. But, you know, as you alluded to earlier, some of the booking, just, you know, like Moose getting the title briefly and then Josh getting it back here, it's hard to predict Impact effectively. So I don't make a habit of it, but that's my initial take.
And I think Deonna Purrazzo would make a very good babyface too. You know, I think she's made a better heel than I expected. And I think she will make a really, really good babyface. And so I'm excited to see that eventual turn. I think at some point that will freshen her up a little bit. I don't necessarily think it needs to happen next week or next month or anything like that. I still think she's got a little bit left in the tank, although losing the title here, having lost the Knockouts title previously, you know, she's not the champ anymore. So she does... If there was ever a time for her to turn, I guess it would be, you know, coming up. How much more do you think they can get out of her as a heel before they do eventually turn her babyface? Or do you feel like her heel run is kind of running out of steam here?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I don't love that this match would happen that quickly. I would prefer it delay, because I think there is more left in the tank for her. And, you know, I think almost universally, any performer in a heel role, if they have the, you know, the charisma to be a good heel, they're going to be a good babyface. But almost always, at least for me, my personal preference is I almost always love their heel personas, their heel runs more than their babyface runs. So I think Deonna is in that zone here as well. So, yeah, I would continue it and just have her, you know, tell another story with her now without any titles. And build to that match if you're going to, you know, have that match be the biggest match you can put on. But, yeah, I wouldn't force anything. I just think it might happen because they want to have a really big match for that show. But, yeah, I would continue her to be a heel character for sure. I think she's got lots of room left in that.
Perhaps one of the most surprising results on the show was the opening match, where Steve Maclin defeated Chris Sabin and Jay White. So there are reports circulating on social media, and I'm not sure where it emanated from off the top of my head, but that Steve Maclin could be in for a big push here in Impact. And I'm one that's been really impressed with his work, both character and in the ring. You know, he kind of got stuck in the X division, and I was skeptical of how that would work out, and I think it worked out pretty well. It allowed him to expand and to show more than he has shown in the past. So, I mean, what do you see as the ceiling for a guy like Steve Maclin in Impact, who was a tag team wrestler for the most part in NXT and WWE, didn't really have much of an opportunity at all on the main roster, things out of his control happening there. But what do you see for his ceiling in Impact right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the limit, right? I mean, that's the beauty of Impact. If you look at, you know, AEW, WWE, and Impact as kind of the big three within North America, as I alluded to earlier, is that, you know, they're in a spot to, you know, really define anyone they want to. And I think that Steve is in a really good spot for Impact, where, you know, I think some people could view him as a WWE or an NXT guy. I don't really view him like that, as you alluded to. He didn't get a lot of time on the main roster, and he was not a primary, you know, in the act that he was in NXT. So he feels like a guy who kind of, you know, has come in fresh and is a good worker and is a good persona, and Impact can latch onto that and make him the guy. And I think they've done that with tons of people in the past. I mean, you could go down the list of it. Just, again, I always compare Impact and Ring of Honor because they're similar in their form in the industry. But just look at, you know, AEW and WWE right now and all the, you know, Impact guys that were quote unquote, you know, lower on the card and then were built up through Impact and became bigger stars. And I just think, you know, I'm not going to guarantee anything here, but you know, Macklin seems like a guy who can follow that trajectory. Still, what, he's in his mid-30s, and in wrestling these days, that's young. So, yeah, I think they could – he's a guy – you know, if you look up and down this card, there's people that are kind of defined, and he's one of those guys that's still new enough to the company and can – you know, winning a match like this, especially against Jay White, and Sabin, too, who's a veteran. But, yeah, you can just – put the rocket on somebody like that in a company like Impact, and it's believable, and it feels, you know, I'm not going to say he's going to be challenging Josh Alexander and winning the title at Slammiversary, but it feels like someone you can build up and it's believable and works in the Impact system, and I think that is one of the many reasons that Impact should remain to be a healthy, viable business, because it's good for the performers and it's good for the industry and good for the fans. So yes, I think he could do that.
If you watched Impact and want to chat with us about the show, 515-605-9345, make sure to press 1 on your keypad to jump in line and talk. We've got two callers on hold, so plenty of room if you would like to talk. You can also email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. I'm Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, joined by PWTorch.com contributor Tyler Sage here on Wrestling Night in America tonight. So let's go to our first phone call. It is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland, kicking us off as usual. Ryan, welcome to the show tonight. What's your first question for us?
My first question is on the two main eventers from last night, Moose and Josh Alexander. Do you know why they've been able to remain in Impact? Because I would think AEW or WWE would have some pretty high interest in them and would be able to offer a much bigger contract for them.
Yeah, these two guys have had a lot of success and impact. You know, Ethan Page moving on to AEW, a former tag team partner of Josh Alexander. You know, I think maybe WWE and to a lesser extent AEW saw Josh Alexander as just kind of a tag team role player at the time. And so, you know, I think looking at it now, obviously that's not the case. You also wonder, you know, Josh Alexander being from Canada, what his visa situation is and how difficult it would be for WWE and AEW to work that out. I don't know. Obviously, Impact has, but I'm not sure what that situation was, especially with the COVID restrictions and everything like that, how easy that would be for him. Moose, he's had some allegations against him that have probably pumped the brakes. I know several years ago, WWE seemed interested in him, and I don't know if they just never worked out contract details or if the allegations that came out about Moose kind of put WWE on the defensive a little bit, but you would think WWE with Moose's size is somebody that would be interested in him, given his athleticism, given his background as a former NFL player, but WWE just hasn't. You know, I don't know if the promos, as much as he's improved on the promos, I don't know if the promos are maybe where WWE would like them to be able to fit into their ecosystem. But I think, Tyler, the one thing that surprises me, you know, Josh Alexander was kind of on the ascent when AEW and Impact were working together. And I thought that AEW would at least want to sample Josh Alexander and say, let's put him in AEW, let's see how he works in front of, you know, a crowd of 4,000 or 5,000 people. Let's see how he's able to connect with a wider audience. And I was surprised that they didn't really do anything with him. I thought maybe he would be one of the guys that AEW would pick to cross over and cross through that forbidden door while they were working together. That ship seems to have sailed, at least for now. So talk a little bit about Josh Alexander and Moose, and they're good fits for Impact, no doubt, but the fact that they haven't worked for AEW or WWE yet.
Yeah, and I mean, so start with Moose first. I think everything you said there, Greg, is spot on, and the most likely scenario there with Moose, I think there's lots of good reporting that you know, Ryan and everyone in the audience can look up to kind of get a fuller picture there. But that is the only thing, especially with WWE. I mean, he is just like made for WWE. His look, his ability is, you know, good enough in the ring for sure. So that's almost got to be a vast majority of the reason why he's not elsewhere at the moment. But with Josh, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a timing thing in a lot of ways, the way I see it. And then, you know, when his contract was up, he was ascending, as you said, Greg, but I do feel like if he would have gone to AEW, you know, it's that whole big fish in a small pond or you know, in the ocean, and he definitely would have been, you know, the small fish in AEW. And I fear, I mean, it didn't happen, but I'm almost sure that he would be an elevated Tony Nese type role where he would be, you know, on Dark and Elevation and winning matches and maybe occasionally be on TV to lose to somebody they're building up. You know, he would lose to a Wheeler Yuta, someone like that that's on the ascent there. And, you know, the money would probably be comparable. I'm not reporting anything here, but I assume whatever Impact's offering him, it wasn't going to be much more in AEW, and he probably bet on himself to continue his rise. And I think he made the right call, if that is the case. Again, all speculation by me. But then to the broader point of him not even getting a shot when the crossover was happening is indicative of, to me, again, just my guess here, of Tony Khan and just kind of what he likes in wrestling. If you look at across the AEW lineup, you know, he's got the people that he loved as a, you know, as a teenager in his 20s. They are, you know, throughout the roster, you know, your Samoa Joes, your Bryan Danielsons, your CM Punks, et cetera. And then he's definitely got a type of people who are, you know, 30 and younger, the Pages, the Coles, the Wheeler Yutas, the MJFs, things like that. And I just don't think that Josh fits his exact type of wrestler that he loves in that role to get a big push. So I think it's something where you have to make yourself a big star and then come over and translate over, which can happen in AEW, but I just think that's more indicative of Tony Khan and what he likes in wrestling more so than Josh, the competitor. So lots of moving pieces there. That's all an assumption by me. That's kind of my read on the situation for both guys. I think Josh is in a good spot and he made the right call. So at least some guy here on the internet is agreeing with his career decision. So there you go.
One more thing on Moose. He turned 38 yesterday, actually. So a pretty rough birthday present to lose the title. So, we've seen wrestlers in their 30s and 40s really hit their stride. That's certainly not a barrier to becoming a big star, but that would be pretty late start for WWE. And, you know, we know that WWE is looking for something different. I think you have to be a pretty big name now and maybe come from AEW. that helps. For WWE to pluck you and to put you right on the main roster. You know, we know that they're looking for different things now. They're not signing independent talent as much with a different philosophy in NXT. So, you know, if you sign Moose, where does he go? Does he go to the main roster? Does he go in NXT? He doesn't really need to be there, especially with his age and experience. But, you know, I don't know if that's exactly what WWE is looking for right now in talent. So, Ryan, we'll go back to you for your second question.
My second question is on CM Punk. Do you think it's pretty given that the main event Forbidden Door pay-per-view is going to be CM Punk against Okada for the AEW title? Because that's the only match I can possibly see main eventing that show.
Yeah, the Forbidden Door pay-per-view announced by Tony Khan, big announcement number 367 from Tony Khan on AEW. Although this one actually was a big announcement. I'll say that. To the people who are downplaying this announcement, I don't get that. This is a pretty big announcement when, you know, arguably the number two and three companies in the world, professional wrestling-wise, are putting on a pay-per-view together. That seems like a big deal. And so I think that, you know, if you look at Punk and you expect him to win the AEW title in May, and then I think this pay-per-view announced for June, Tyler, Forbidden Door?
Yeah, it's like okay. June 22nd. So it's a Sunday in June, yeah.
Okay, June 22nd. So about a month after the May pay-per-view for, I believe, Double or Nothing is the May pay-per-view for AEW. So is it if Punk wins the title, and I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but if Punk wins the title against Hangman Adam Page at the May pay-per-view for AEW, is Punk Okada the main event that this group should run with?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, so if you look in a vacuum, that's easily the biggest match that, you know, if you do a co-branded pay-per-view and you're going to have singles matches, that's the biggest match you can put on. So there's a, you know, you have to ask yourself, are you going to have a second pay-per-view like this a year from now? Do you want to save that for down the line? Do you want to plant the seeds for that? Or do you want to just do the biggest matches you can do right now to pop a number and make money for both companies? So there's that aspect of it. There's also the other aspect of, you know, if they do a bunch of singles matches, then especially at the top there, how's that match going to go, right? Because neither AEW nor New Japan are going to want their top guy to lose in the main event of a co-branded pay-per-view. We just saw a third night of Wrestle Kingdom where there was one singles match and there were a lot of tag matches so that you could trade losses with guys that were not as important. And I think that's going to be very vital, more so from the New Japan side than the AEW side, to protect people. But that's a big question mark. That's not very exciting to talk about here because it's kind of a wet blanket answer. So I apologize for that. I think there'll be a lot of tag matches. But on the other point there of not knowing who's going to win, I would love a clean finish. And I think if you did CM Punk versus someone like Tanahashi, you get the legend versus legend match, and Tanahashi can lose that a little more easily than Okada can. You can build for that Okada Punk match down the line. And then I actually think, you know, I think MJF is arguably the biggest star in AEW, at least in my opinion. And him versus someone like Okada, I think, is kind of a sneaky good option, and you can tell the match with MJF until you get to that point. So that's kind of my outside the box answer. I just don't think that both companies politics wise are going to allow a singles match between the two top guys and not have it be a finish that is not desirable for anyone to see. So that's kind of my take on the situation as of now.
We'll talk a little bit about the Forbidden Door pay-per-view after we finish up with Ryan. Ryan, your third and final question for us tonight.
My final question is, I attended the local Royal Rumble match for the local promotion. It was one of the most clever finishes I've ever seen.
I hope they didn't call it a Royal Rumble match. Otherwise, Jerry McDevitt will be on the phone with them quickly.
I think it might have been called the Elite Rumble. But what happened was this ninja came in, and the ninja won the match, and the ninja took off his mask, and it was the local top heel of the promotion, Shane Malice. Could you picture WWE maybe doing this same scenario, say, like Seth Rollins comes in at number one and gets eliminated in like 2 minutes, and then comes in at 30 as a conquistador or some other costume and sneaks his way into winning the Royal Rumble?
I think you're playing with fire if you're WWE doing something like that. I think it's putting more heat on the company. Presumably it's a heel who would do this. So you're trying to put heat on the heel when in actuality, in this day and age, most of the heat is going to go on the company for something like that, especially if it's someone they don't want to see in that role. So, you know, and then you'd have to try to explain, okay, what led to Adam Pearce or whatever decision maker putting together the Rumble, what led to them putting this person in the match? Especially since they're, you know, if they're a conquistador, for example, you know, it's not someone who's part of the roster. Did they know it was going to be Seth Rollins under a mask? So, I mean, the more questions that you start to ask yourself, the worse it's going to be. Because I think the Rumble, you know, I think the Royal Rumble match, one of the reasons I love it is because it does provide a lot of avenues for different booking scenarios that you won't see throughout the rest of the year. But you have to be careful, Tyler, because you don't want to get into these booking scenarios that put heat on the company. And I think you'd very much run the risk of doing that with Ryan's scenario that he laid out.
Yeah. And I agree with you, Greg, there that it's probably more trouble than it's worth. If I can play devil's advocate though, just because it's fun, I think you could, if you're WWE and you want to tell a story with that person, you could reverse that Rumble situation, right? You could have Seth Rollins come in a mask at number 3 or something, and gets eliminated. Somehow you don't know it's him. It would be hard to avoid with his tattoos, and you probably have to do the full bodysuit, et cetera. But if he's eliminated as that character and comes back at 30 as himself and then wins, you could then theoretically tell a story of, a little bit, and this is not main events, so this is not helping my argument here, but, kind of like the Ezekiel and Elias thing where it's, a whodunit sort of fun thing happening, and you could then lead to a match at, the in-between pay-per-view where he maybe is going against the person that rightfully should have won because he was illegal, and they can wrestle for a spot at WrestleMania. Not ideal, but you could tell a story over a series of weeks with that. But again, I would not advise that because of everything you said out there, Greg. But I think that's also a great reason of why local independent shows are so much fun, because you can do stuff like that and you're not emotionally, attached and going to talk about it on podcasts and listen to podcasts about it. And it's just, it's just a different level. And I think that's the beauty of having a show like that, because you can do really fun, innovative stuff like that and not have to worry about it as a promoter, like, oh, is this not going to read well to the 2 million people watching the product? So, I think it's a super fun idea, and that's why I love indie shows. So.
I think the thing you can do, too, you can sort of get into that happy medium area. Like, WWE has done this before with Mick Foley, the Three Faces of Foley coming out in the Royal Rumble. But you could easily have someone do this, but just not have them win. And you can have something develop out of that. That way you kind of – You play that card, but you don't play it to the extreme where people are going to hate the finish of the match. So, or you run the risk of people hating the finish of the match. So you could try it, but just not have the person win. That's an alternative to that, where you kind of get the fun part of it, which is someone coming out dressed as someone else or trying to re-enter the Rumble in a different number, in a different outfit, as a different character. But you don't have the weight of winning to go along with it. So I think that's possible too. Ryan, thank you for the phone call tonight. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. And my solution to the Punk is have Punk win in June and have Okada win the Tokyo Dome match for the rematch. So they're 1-1 and everyone goes home happy. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah, thank you. And, we'll talk more about that when we get to the Forbidden Door discussion about what sort of comes out of this? What's the next step after this pay-per-view for AEW and New Japan's working agreement? But before we do that, let's take our next phone call. It is Reverend Keith from Baltimore, Maryland. Reverend Keith, welcome to Wrestling Night in America tonight.
Thank you so much for taking my call tonight at this time, Greg. I really appreciate it. Tyler, it's always good talking to you, and I want to commend you and Zach Hayden paid on for the wonderful work that you guys are doing on the YouTube side, man. I really like it, the Fireside Chat, and you guys have really done an impeccable job. You need to tell Wade to give you guys a raise.
I'm going to save this clip, and thank you, Keith. I appreciate that.
Yes. Listen, I want to say that I'm happy for Josh Alexander and finally winning, and hopefully he can hold on to this Impact Worlds Championship. It was a six-month story, which culminated in a very positive ending. You don't always see that in the wrestling world today. So I thought Impact did an impeccable job of culminating this feud. And I think that we may see less and less of Moose, because I had read where he was wrestling with multiple injuries, so he may be taking some time off. So it'll be interesting to see who steps up next. Now, I know from what I've read that Sami Callihan is coming back, and I think he was the one behind the video clip last night. So we don't know if he's coming back as a face or heel, but it will be interesting to see who steps up as Josh Alexander's next challenger. Do you have any suggestions, Tyler?
Oh, man. I mean, I think the Callihan, that works well for me, especially, he's an established guy, former champ, and, can tell an interesting story, and you can build that and have that feel like a big match for Slammiversary, which is, just 2 months away, or not even, 6-7 weeks. So that seems the most likely to me. But, again, I'm not the expert on Impact, so there might be someone I'm missing clearly. I mean, you know, Matt Cardona could always use another belt. You could tell that story too, but I don't know if that is as big level. That seems more like a TV episode than a pay-per-view. I'm curious what Greg would think about that. I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, if he hadn't lost last night, he'd be at the top of my list. The fact that he lost tells me maybe he's not under consideration right now. But Jonah, you know, you look at some of the matches that he's had of late, both on Impact and elsewhere, they have been some of the matches that are the most talked about. You know, he had a match in Impact with PCO that was a very wild match. It was the most talked about match of that show. But he lost to Ishii last night. So I don't know if that tells you that maybe he's not on the radar for Josh Alexander, but I've really been impressed with Jonah and the way he's been booked since he's come in. They seem to be relatively protective of him, which makes last night's result a little more interesting. But he's a guy who maybe not first for Josh Alexander, but down the line I see him as quite the challenge with his size and everything like that. How would Josh Alexander play that? So I like Jonah as someone who could put a scare into Josh Alexander and potentially be a pay-per-view challenger for Alexander. If not pay-per-view, then, you know, the off-monthly exclusive shows that they do that are not really pay-per-view events, but they're shows that they build to on television. So that's the name that stands out to me, Reverend Keith. I'm not sure if you had anybody else in mind.
That's fine. That's fine. I can live with that. It would be either way, whether Sami Callihan or Jonah, I think it would be either one would serve as a formidable opponent for Josh. And I just hope that they allow Josh to have a nice title reign. I mean, he really is one of the more underrated wrestlers in the business today. And I think that he's often perceived as only a tag team wrestler for his days with Ethan Page in the North. So it's good to see him branch out and you know, get this major title under his belt and on his resume, because I think, as you guys alluded to earlier with Ryan, that somewhere down the line, either AEW or WWE is going to come running. I don't know if Josh's age, but he still has a lot of gas left in the tank, and I'm sure he still has a few bumps left on his bump card. So I can see him stepping up to a major promotion down the road. Moving on, I know you guys are going to talk about the Forbidden Door, but I just want to say this in advance of that discussion, that going to be tough for both promotions to be able to map out who's going to win, who's going to lose. I was listening to Brian Alvarez, Dave Meltzer, Garrett Gonzalez on separate shows on Wrestling Observer, and they were talking about all the different matchups you could possibly have. However, what they will probably do in the traditional New Japan Pro Wrestling fashion, they'll probably have a whole bunch of tag team matches just to get everybody on the card. You know, you could do NJPW versus AEW and Ring of Honor in tag matches. You know how they like to throw five and four-man tag team matches together so that you can get your Clark Connors, your Yuri Mayors, and, you know, those guys from the New Japan Pro Wrestling Dojo on the card. Plus, you got to look at, it's going to be tough to book, you know, the major players in AEW versus the major players in New Japan. You know, for example, you know, you got guys like Suzuki and Ishii who can take losses, which they do on a regular basis. However, then when it comes down to Okada and Tanahashi and Will Ospreay, you got to look at, okay, who's gonna be booked to lose out of those three? You know, do you book them against your Punks and your Bryan Danielsons, or do you throw them in tag matches? So it'll be interesting to see how this card is formulated. I tend to think that there's going to be more tag matches, just like how they booked their Battle of the Super Juniors in this last sequence of shows that they just had in New Japan. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's what Tyler mentioned when Ryan brought that topic up, and I tend to agree. Not only would you do that, Tyler, book those predominantly tag matches on this first show, but I think the reason, part of the reason you do that too, is to kind of tease what's to come. And we'll talk about that a little more when we talk about the Forbidden Door, but presumably if all goes well, AEW and New Japan will make this a semi-regular thing. And perhaps you want to hold off some of those big singles matches. You know, maybe the top of the card will be your big singles matches, but there could be other singles matches that you don't want to blow on the first show. You know that the interest level is going to be high for the first show working together. You can get away with putting a lot of trios matches or eight-man tag matches on this show because people are just going to want to see, at least for the first show, these two companies interact with each other and see how it goes. And that curiosity factor is going to draw a lot of people. If they do shows subsequent to this, that may be where you need to have more of the singles matches. And by doing a lot of tag matches on this first show, you save those singles matches for the future. What do you think about that, Tyler?
Yeah, I think the best approach, if I was, you know, if I was the czar of booking this pay-per-view for both companies, it is to do like a hybrid approach where, you know, it's an AEW New Japan show, so you're going to probably have 10 matches on the pay-per-view, which is way too many, but that's what we're going to get. So I would do, you know, if you do a hybrid approach of having, you know, I also would try and leverage Stardom to get a match out of, you know, some talent there. You could do a tag match for AEW versus Stardom too. I don't know if that's on the table, but if you did, you know, six tag matches and four singles matches, I think that's a healthy approach to, you know, have some top quality matches that you can, that can go 18 to 22 minutes and be the theme of the show coming out of it. And then, yeah, like you said, Greg, that you can tease other stuff. You can do your Bullet Club versus Chaos match, and you can have the Bullet Club dissension and from AEW Bullet Club and New Japan Bullet Club. You can tell all the stories to lead the singles matches down the line. And all you have to do is just make good on having some guys touch that you never thought you'd see touch. And I think also having some ability to not guarantee another show in the future, but to do that in a way that, you know, like, hey, this, if you have a moment, you know, two, three more moments that you're setting up for another show down the line, as a viewer, I feel pretty confident that you think this relationship is going to continue. So if there's not a bunch of singles matches, but you have a bunch of moments where you tease Okada and Punk and you tease, you know, Ibushi and Kenny maybe look at each other and you're like, oh, is this match going to finally happen? And not in Noah, is, you know, things like that could happen. And you know, that, hey, more's coming down the line. And that's a healthy way to grow this. And I'm sure we'll talk about more here. But, yeah, a hybrid approach is what I would do.
I think more so than Punk Okada, more so than any singles match, the thing I'm most looking forward to on this joint show between New Japan and AEW is the interaction between Danhausen and Yano. That is what I am. If we get that, it's a 10.0 from me in the roundtable review.
Well,
so that's what I'm putting it out there.
Yeah, you probably need that Orange Cassidy, make that triple threat, and then you really got something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So.
Now you're talking. Now you're talking some business right there. Reverend Keith, I'll go back to you for your final question for us tonight.
Okay, shifting gears, I want to discuss the WWE and preferably SmackDown. I was listening to the post show the other night after SmackDown went off the air, and it was Zach and Mike Myers and Nick from Brattleboro, who I normally don't agree with too often, but I have to give him his roses and flowers this time. He brought up a good point about the Lacey Evans promos. And I'm in total agreement of the discussion that came out of Nick's point. He was saying that it's starting to be overkill with her feel-good story, which I love. I admire that. And most of us who have followed Lacey Evans from day one know her story, okay? But now, after three consecutive weeks of this, it's WWE at some point needs to stop, and I'm going to tell you why. And I tweeted this the other night. Can you imagine if each and every woman on the WWE roster, including NXT, gave their testimony, okay? Can you imagine? She's not the only one that struggles. She's not the only one that's endured what she has. But you've got to look at it like this. Follow me. She came up as a babyface, okay? Then she did some dastardly deeds as a heel. prior to her announcement of her pregnancy, she was involved in a very controversial storyline with Nature Boy Ric Flair. So now we are expected to forget about all of that, okay? And all of a sudden, because of her struggles, we are supposed to cheer her as, I guess, the number one or rising to the top, number one babyface female. And it's like, okay, enough is enough. You know, either the fans are going to cheer for her or they're going to remember what she did in the past and reject her. And I think the more that they keep bringing up, as they talked about on the SmackDown post show, the more they keep bringing up her struggles, the worse it's going to be for her when the fans turn. That's giving the fans more ammunition to use against her. And I just think that the WWE is setting themselves up right now and with this storyline. What are your thoughts on it?
I guess I don't feel that strongly on it. I think if WWE wants to go with this character of Lacey Evans, it makes sense to give the full picture and the full story. And if that full story takes 3 weeks of vignettes to play out, then let it play out, I guess. You know, I think that's a very pessimistic view of WWE fans, I think, that they would reject Lacey Evans because they're tired of hearing about her struggles. And yes, everybody struggles, but that's not the crux of their character the way it has been built for Lacey Evans. And you can argue whether or not her character should.
Greg, can I say something real quick? Greg, let me say something. No. I think you misunderstood me. I'm not saying that the fans, I'm saying that if she turns heel down the road, that they may use this against her. I'm not saying right now. That's what I want to make clear, because I'm a very optimistic person. I don't want you to perceive what I'm saying in the wrong light. What I'm saying is, okay, the more that they present her struggles and the way that she is presenting her struggles, which she's doing a great job. Don't get me wrong. I like what she's doing. And I know that this is not of her doing. This is of the WWE writing team's doing. So I'm not placing any blame on Lacey Evans. So I want you to understand. My point is the writing team, the way that they are portraying her struggles, At some point, should she turn heel, or let's say the fans get tired of this feel-good moment or goody-two-shoes type stance, as you know fans can do, whether it's WWE fans, AEW fans, Ring of Honor, New Japan fans will turn on you. I'm thinking myself, what I'm saying is all of everything that they are announcing that she's endured, which I'm sure there's so many other women that have endured just as much, if not more, but they're presenting a picture with just her. The point I'm trying to make is at some point, we don't need to know everything. That's what I'm saying, in that the more they present, the more it's going, it should she turn heel again or the fans turn on her, those same fans that saying, oh man, that I'm so sorry you went through this, will be the same ones that use everything that she went through against her. That's the point I was trying to make.
Yeah, I don't think you book this kind of character thinking about her turning heel later on. You know, I think WWE, as we've seen from their booking, they're not that farsighted. They don't think that far ahead. You know, she hasn't even debuted this character on television yet. I don't think we should be looking at it as what happens if she turns heel with this character. Like, I'm not really sure that's the point of this character. And so, you know, again, I understand what they're doing. I understand playing the sympathy angle. I also understand that other women have gone through things that, I mean, this makes Lacey Evans a character that people want to root for and people who want to do well. My biggest thing is, and Reverend Keith, you kind of brought this up a little bit, is, you know, this is a very far cry from the character she had been portraying. And it's very jarring to go from one to this one without much of an explanation. If you had Lacey Evans in that first vignette say, you know, I'm going to tell you the real story of Lacey Evans, not the story of, you know, the sassy Southern Belle, which, you know, that was just me trying to mask my insecurities. Here's why I did that. You know, if she had come out and said that, it's almost as if, and Tyler, you can jump off on this point, it's almost as if WWE is choosing to completely ignore everything her entire heel run on the main roster and almost present a completely different person.
That's
which,
the problem.
Which, you know, that's it, it's again, and this is nothing new for WWE. It's treating your fans like low IQ viewers that they don't recognize. Oh, wait a minute, this is Lacey Evans. What happened to the old Lacey Evans? So, I mean, Tyler, what's your take on the Lacey Evans character and especially how it compares to the previous character she was playing and the lack of explanation we've gotten to how those two mix?
Yeah, so I think Keith hit the nail on the head with a comment he had early on in his question here. And that was, you know, Keith, probably paraphrasing, I didn't write it down, but it was that, you know, does WWE expect us to forget everything that she did in the past? And, like, literally,
yeah,
yes,
that's what I'm trying
expect.
To say.
Yeah. So that's my view of it, and that is a pessimistic view of kind of and not all WWE booking, because, like, the top tier stuff, you know, the Brock and Roman story, all the stuff with Roman, there's a lot of effort put into that to be good long-term storytelling. It's just this, to me, feels like not important on that level within WWE is something like that is. So they essentially assume that most people will vaguely remember the name of Lacey Evans, but if she has a new character and we tell them, hey, here's this, you know, the story, and how could you not get behind somebody that's telling the story, that it'll essentially be a reset on her character and all that craziness she was doing before we can forget. And, you know, she can take on Charlotte at the, you know, at Money in the Bank or whatever the next pay-per-view is after Backlash. And we can set her up in that role. And then once she loses that, she can kind of, you know, merge back into traffic and be, you know, a top three baby face on SmackDown. And, you know, that's like kind of a clinical view at this, but I think that's how WWE operates. If you're not a top three person, male or female in the company, then you kind of are in these slotted roles and whatever's approved from the writing standpoint and kind of goes, and they assume that the audience is just going to basically accept it. And sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. That's kind of where we are here. I think she will be accepted as a babyface, and, you know, all this stuff is just redundant. And I think that's also an issue I personally have with WWE is the kind of redundancy of stories week in and week out. It makes it harder to watch than like Impact, let's say. But yeah, I think that's kind of just a more holistic approach to how WWE, you know, redefines characters that they don't think are the most important things on the show. So, yeah.
Reverend Keith, appreciate the phone call tonight, sir.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Tyler, for seconding my opinions and my thoughts, because that's exactly where I was going, that WWE thinks that all of their fans have selective retention, which most of us have a good memory. So thank you, gentlemen. Have a good night. Take care. Talk to you soon. God bless.
Absolutely. Thank you, Reverend Keith. 515-605-9345 if you'd like to call and talk. WNIALivecast@gmail.com is where you can find our email address and email us anytime, and we'll read your question or comment on air and discuss it. Tyler Sage and Greg Parks here with you tonight. I want to talk more about the Forbidden Door, just a couple minutes here, Tyler. And one of the questions I have is, you know, we have seen some pretty big New Japan names in AEW, Jay White, Ishii, Minoru Suzuki. Does the fact that some of these big names and really the guys that viewers would really be interested in seeing interact with AEW wrestlers, does the fact that they've already appeared on AEW TV soften this news a little bit? Is it not as major news maybe for some people because we've already seen some wrestlers cross over into AEW?
Yeah, I think it depends how you look at it. I think for people like you and I, if I can assume how you view wrestling, Greg, and people that are listening to this show, you know, kind of getting going to PWTorch.com on a regular basis, I think it is exciting news. I think if you are more of a casual viewer of the product, you feel like, yes, you've seen guys from New Japan and you don't really get any story from them, and they kind of pop in for a day, for a week, maybe they come back, but they lose and they don't feel as important. And for someone like that, I don't think it's as big of news. I mean, to go wild predictions here, you know, whatever Double or Nothing does from a buy rate standpoint, I assume that the Forbidden Door show will do less. You know, you might build to a Forbidden Door 2 show that does more than what Double or Nothing does this year, but I do think that this is a long-term process for, you know, the, let's say, 800,000 hardcore fans that watch AEW week in and week out, no matter what. They're all very excited about this, but to get that, you know, additional million that are watching Raw in comparison to that, it'll take time, and the AEW and New Japan have not done a great job making those fans care about this and why this is important. And there's a lot of potential to build this show on TV, and I hope that they will, but, you know, that has not been AEW's strong point as of yet, is to build well-known characters to Tony Khan and people that really like wrestling, but not to build them to the more casual audience. So I think this is a big question, you know, for the next 2 months to see if AEW corrects that course of how they have booked people that are in that zone, or if they will continue.
One of the other things, I sort of alluded to this in answering one of the questions, was what's next? You know, it's hard to talk about what's next when we don't even know the booking going into this show. We don't know any of the participants yet. We can only speculate. But that's what podcasts are for. So let's do it. I mean, this is New Japan versus AEW. You know, we talked about the potential of the first show being predominantly tag matches, maybe to lead to another show down the line where the draw is more singles matches. And, you know, there's also the potential of having AEW talent perhaps in the G1 this summer in New Japan. So, you know, what if this is successful and if they do well, do you see this becoming a regular, semi-regular thing on pay-per-view? Do you see, you know, Bryan Danielson, one of the reasons that he left WWE is because he wanted to participate in the G1 at some point. You know, do you see somebody the level of a Danielson or a Moxley participating in the G1 this year? Do you see that kind of crossover into New Japan at some point for some of the AEW wrestlers now that this Forbidden Door seems to be open?
Yeah, I think that's the ideal scenario for at least me as a consumer and as a fan. I don't know if in a year or two from now it's going to be the ideal scenario for someone like Tony Khan to continue a relationship like that, but that's yet to be seen. But, yeah, I do think that's what will happen here because, you know, this could be a jumping-off point for, let's say, the North American viewer and the, you know, the Japanese viewer too. I mean, AEW is now streaming on New Japan World, so it's more easily consumed across the Pacific Ocean as well, so which is great. But yeah, I think this leads to, so like you said, you know, maybe it's not both Moxley and Danielson, but I think you'll get some top tier and some mid tier talent. You know, I could see someone like a Wheeler Yuta or someone else who want to like get a lot of seasoning in the ring in that style of match could be G1 participants. So, you know, if you have 3 out of the 20 participants are AEW people, I think that makes sense. And, you know, that could also lead to not Chris Jericho, but a Chris Jericho-esque co-main event from an AEW star that we haven't seen yet at Wrestle Kingdom, especially if that's going to continue to add nights in perpetuity if we have a 4th, 5th night. Just kidding, don't want to put that out there. But that leads there, and you know, then does that mean you get loans for top talent? Does, you know, people like Naito and Suzuki are doing independent shows with, you know, 200, 300 people. Would they want to do 2 months in the States and tell a story that leads to a pay-per-view match? I mean, that almost has to happen if you want this deal to be fair from both parties. And I could also see this being an annual event because, you know, whether, you know, you want to look at everything from a idealistic standpoint, Tony Khan is a capitalist, and continuing to add pay-per-views is just the natural course of action to make more revenue for your company. And I can see this as a sneaky way to get a 5th pay-per-view every year. If you don't want to like break your whatever thing, you know, you're only going to have 4 forever. This is a good way to break that and have a 5th show that people pay for. So also, you know, it depends, but I think you alluded to it very slightly at the beginning of the show here, but you know, Dax Harwood's talked about his pending free agency, just like MJF has. And, you know, if the money's even and you're a guy who loves, or a woman who loves professional wrestling, any of the option to kind of dabble in some New Japan stuff, that could be, that could make a decision for somebody, a top star that maybe wants to bounce around, doesn't want to be tied down to only WWE. So I think that there's a couple options there, but all that seems to be key there. And I hope I answered your initial question. I know I tangented there at the end. As I do.
Well, to your benefit, it is hard to answer that question because there's so little we know about this pay-per-view. So to kind of extrapolate mm-hmm. out from that already is even harder to do. But I thought it would be a good talking point because this relationship is something that was really off the table at one point when mm-hmm. AEW started. And now that they are actually working together, it opens up a whole world of possibilities, quite literally, with these two companies joining together. So it will be interesting to see how that evolves after the Forbidden Door pay-per-view and what the fallout is from that. We'll go back to the phones, the 111 area code. I believe this is Craig from Toledo. Craig, welcome to Wrestling Night in America tonight. Oh, maybe it's not Craig. It's just the bell tolls for thee, Tyler. So
I think I warped to another dimension there, but I appreciate that. Keep you on your toes.
You've now entered the Twilight Zone portion of Wrestling Night in America. let's go to talking about, speaking of New Japan, they had their Windy City Riot show in Chicago last weekend, and the results were the Factory, defeat QT Marshall, Nick Camarado, and Aaron Solo, defeating Carl Fredericks, Clark Connors, and Yuya Uemura. Match number two, Fred Rosser, Josh Alexander, Alex Coughlin, Ren Narita, and Chris Dickinson, defeating Royce Isaacs, Jor-El Nelson, J.R. Kratos, Black Tiger, and Danny Limelight. Tom Lawler defeating Eugene Nagata. Henare, Great Okan, Jeff Cobb, TJP, Mark Davis, and Kyle Fletcher defeating Hikuleo, Chris Bay, ELP, Anderson Gallows, and Scott Flash Norton. Flashback to WCW with that one. Match number five, Finn Juice and Brody King defeating Jonah, Shane Haste, and Bad Dude Tito in a Chicago street fight. Jay White over Shota Umino. Ishii defeating Minoru Suzuki and Jon Moxley over Will Ospreay. Moxley and Ospreay put on a heck of a main event in this one. A lot of crossover here. You had AEW guys with the Factory and Jon Moxley. You had Impact Wrestling guys with Anderson and Gallows and Josh Alexander. And you had New Japan guys, New Japan and New Japan Strong. And for me, New Japan Strong is always one of the shows that if I had like an extra hour in the week, I would try to watch. But there's just always not enough time for me to watch that show. So this was actually my first introduction to, and I've read a lot about these guys, so the names are very familiar to me. But for me, this is the first time I've gotten to see a lot of these New Japan Strong wrestlers. And so that was cool for me to be able to watch this. The other impression I had, besides Moxley and Ospreay being such a good match, is the Chicago street fight was really long. There was one match that was really long, and I didn't note it. I don't know if it was that one or the match before it that long.
That was the longest match, the street fight, yeah. So you're right.
Okay, yeah. And it felt every minute of it, too. I mean, it was a really long match. I thought they could have cut it in half, probably, and been a lot better. Mm-hmm. The guys that actually jumped out to me most of the names that I was familiar with but I hadn't seen in action yet was Mark Davis and Kyle Fletcher as a tag team. They've made a name for themselves coming from Australia and wrestling a little bit in New Japan and stuff like that. But Aussie Open, Fletcher and Davis were really good in that tag match. And in a tag match like that with so many names, it's really hard to stand out. But I thought they did a really nice job. And they caught my eye more so than anyone else who I was unfamiliar with but catching for the first time. So, kind of an amalgam of all these wrestling companies here on this show was pretty wild. I don't know how much you've seen of New Japan Strong or anything like that, Tyler. If you're comfortable talking about any of these, the Alex Coghlans or Danny Limelight, Clark Connors, Carl Fredericks. Obviously, we know Fred Rosser, the former Darren Young, who now has a shaved head. But, I mean, if not, I mean, just look, when you look at these results, anything stand out to you from this?
Yeah, so on the Strong stuff, I'm in the same boat as you, but a lot of those names you mentioned I've seen in other places, a Strong, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Strong crossover from the previous years. That was almost similar rosters, at least from, minus Tom Lawler and the Australian fellows that you discussed here. But I think, this to me, if I can go 30,000 foot view, is that this is kind of, I would expect is like a best case scenario of an amalgamation pay-per-view from a, on paper, what you can book standpoint. And that's why the Forbidden Door in 2 months, like almost to the day, is so interesting, because a lot of the New Japan talent we saw on here are the ones that have kind of cycled in and out of AEW and Impact, and people that we've, seen in North America a lot. The only time we've seen Okada is at the All In show that, Cody and the Bucks put on years ago to kind of put all this in motion. But that's why this is kind of like for me, a list of people that you need to expand from here and add, your Okadas, your Tanahashis, your, I dare say it, Evils, probably for people that watch New Japan don't want me to say that, but myself included. But, there's names that are not on here that are huge, huge stars in New Japan that aren't on this list. And I think them being part of that Forbidden Door really is what's going to set that and make that feel like a special event here. But, beyond that, I think Moxley defeating Will Ospreay, obviously being a great match, but that is definitely interesting and of notes for both men's trajectories. I would have thought it would be the other way, just from where I think where Ospreay ranks right now in New Japan and where Moxley ranks with, him in a faction and having a story for the next 6 months off that. That was surprising to me. But yeah, everything else, the Jay White and Umino stuff was really, really good. And Umino got put over big by Moxley. I thought, he's not going to be a top guy immediately, but I think that he's got a lot of potential, obviously, as a graduated young lion. So those are kind of the highlights for me on the show. But it's more of a barometer of, the Forbidden Door show has to have, about three or four huge names from both companies that weren't on this show to make it feel like it's a huge event. So that's what I'm looking out for.
What do you see the future of New Japan being in America? They've got this show, which is sort of a minor pay-per-view on Fight TV. They've got the Forbidden Door with AEW, which is going to get them more traction in the United States than they would otherwise. We know they had big plans for an American expansion before COVID, but what do you see as the future of New Japan in the U.S., and how would that affect any deal that they have with AEW?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I'm not on the inner workings of New Japan, but, Rocky handles a lot of the English-speaking stuff, at least if you believe all the reports you read. And Rocky Romero, that is, I should clarify. They've, like you said, I mean, this event was, I'm looking at the attendance here, reported is almost 2,300 people. And, the sound quality was not good for the feed, at least if you watched it live. I don't know if it was patched on repeat. But, there's something about having big ideas and also executing them. And, New Japan has made inroads in North America, but I think it's different. It's a different landscape pre and post AEW with the attention that they can get in there. And, if they were to do a full push, I think at best they'd be third. Maybe they could overtake Impact if they had a TV deal, but they're just never going to have their top tier talent in availability enough in North America to then not hurt the product back home in Japan. So I think it would behoove them to try and get AEW fans to watch the product that aren't right now and get subs on New Japan World and follow it that way. At least, from a, 1 to 3 year viewpoint if I were them. And then for AEW, I think Tony Khan's going to be pretty aggressive to not allow them to, you know, he doesn't have full control or anything, but I doubt the relationship would be very strong if they, you know, moved in and had weekly shows that were on American television. I think you'd see that relationship go away pretty quickly. So I think if they work together and there's fans in Japan and hardcore fans that maybe don't watch AEW but love New Japan, you get them on, that's a win for them and for New Japan. If you get, you know, another 50,000 subs to New Japan World monthly, that's a huge deal, and that's why you do shows like that. And obviously splitting the revenue for the Forbidden Door, but that's where I see it, and I think that's the best for me and for wrestling fans to kind of get the best of both worlds, not have it turn into a competition years out. But I guess that's my hopeful approach to it. And as we know in business, and especially in the wrestling business, things are not always that nice and clean, so we'll see what happens.
That's right. So, it'll be interesting to see, you know, at the end of the year, what we're talking about in terms of New Japan and what kind of inroads they've made in America. And as you said, you know, it may just be, let's get as many American people interested in our Japanese product as possible and hit those subs and maybe come and tour America a couple times a year with some big names or maybe not so big names. And if, you know, if you can draw 2,300 fans with, you know, Minoru Suzuki and Jay White and Will Ospreay and not have to bring over Okada and not have to bring over Tanahashi and Naito and stuff like that, maybe you do that. And maybe that's about the extent of it, at least for now. So that could be the plan. We'll finish up here talking about WrestleMania Backlash. We won't do a full preview or anything like that. That'll be for next week when Frank Pettiani joins me, PWTorch.com contributor. He'll be on to help me preview the WrestleMania Backlash pay-per-view that's coming up. And appropriately named, as we do have a couple WrestleMania rematches, Charlotte Flair versus Ronda Rousey will be an I Quit match for the SmackDown Women's Championship, Cody Rhodes versus Seth Rollins in another singles match. We have RK-Bro versus the Usos in a tag title unification match, AJ Styles versus Edge, and Happy Corbin versus Madcap Moss. Want to focus on the lack of Roman Reigns here. That was always the risk coming out of the match with Brock Lesnar is, okay, but where do you go next? And it seemed like Shinsuke Nakamura, but then we didn't really get much follow-up at all on SmackDown this week. The focus seemed to be Usos and RK-Bro. Roman Reigns and I should say Brock Lesnar not booked for WrestleMania Backlash. So what, if anything, do you do with Roman Reigns at this show? Can you get away with not having him defend the title at this show? Can you get away with him putting the focus on the Usos and RK-Bro and maybe main eventing with that?
Yeah, I mean, it seems tough, but, you know, I think WWE can basically do whatever it wants and it's going to retain a solid portion of the audience. And, you know, you and I are going to watch it. We're going to talk about it. We're going to also watch the following SmackDown and Raw afterwards. So, you know, that's the pro and the con of having such a hardcore and loyal fan base is that you erode slowly, not quickly, with decisions like that. But, yeah, I mean, it seems almost impossible to at least not him have him on the show. I can see him being integral to that match and being at ringside. And if they win, celebrating. If they lose, obviously not celebrating. And maybe that's the main event is him and Heyman doing something with the Usos that you're not expecting. Or, you know, if the Usos win, does he challenge Randy Orton right there and defeat him just to get another notch on his belt? And it's, you know, in a heel fashion, a guy who just worked a 20-minute match has to wrestle because he's not going to turn down an opportunity, something like that. I can see that. Is that rewarding for me as a viewer? Absolutely not. But, you know, we still have, what, two more SmackDowns before the show? So they could, yeah. I mean, they would have to shoot the angle this Friday. But, yeah, I don't know. It seems like, you know, obviously Brock was the plan, do something there, and then that fell through for whatever reason. And, you know, it seems like this is now, if you're going to do it, the kind of a impromptu you know, maybe we call this the Steve Austin effect, where you don't call it a match, and then you have a match, and people love it, so you're all good. That could be the negative effects of that working so well at WrestleMania. I don't know, I'm just spitballing there, but yeah, it seems, you know, incredible that you could have this biggest WrestleMania match of all time to unify the belt, and then you don't get any follow-up for weeks, essentially, on TV. It's just is malpractice from a promotion standpoint.
You know, I think, though, you know, part of the problem is there's such a dearth of contenders for Roman Reigns to face. You know, Drew McIntyre is probably the biggest name, and he's wrapped up with Sami Zayn right now. I think they've got a steel cage match coming up on SmackDown this week. So, you know, maybe Drew beats Sami Zayn and then challenges Roman Reigns at WrestleMania Backlash. It, you know, for a match that should feel big with McIntyre, who carried Raw in 2020 and 2021, you would think that his first match with Roman Reigns should get more than a week build. But, I mean, if doesn't it also speak to if WWE can get away with a pay-per-view not having to worry about an opponent for Roman Reigns because they are so thin on having opponents for him, if they can build up the Usos versus RK-Bro to the point where it feels like a pay-per-view main event, you know, wouldn't it be in WWE's best interest? Isn't it a boon for WWE to not have to just put Reigns there just to put him on there against an opponent no one believes he's going to beat anyway?
Yeah, I mean, both sides you can argue. I think there was in a perfect world, there's plenty of time to build someone. To
I mean,
let's use Shinsuke
Nakamura as an example because they teased that last the previous week. It you know. Is it better if Roman Reigns faces Shinsuke Nakamura in a match no one believes Nakamura is going to have a chance at winning? Or is it better if they have, you know, Roman Reigns do character work where he's, you know, he's behind the Usos in their match with RK-Bro, talking about how important it is that they win, basically threatening them if they lose that, you know, they won't be part of the bloodline anymore. Is that a better role for Reigns at this show than just kind of going through the motions and putting him in a match against someone just to put him in a match?
Yeah, I would say in a vacuum, I agree. I think him doing character work would be better in making a match that's not him. Is more interesting and kind of extends his run at the top here in a weird way. It also feels, I just feel dirty saying that out loud because it kind of feels like you're punting on as a promotion on like, hey, we know we don't have anybody and that's like on us. But, you know, so I don't love giving credit for that if I'm being honest. But in the situation presented in front of us, yes. I mean, the unification match for the tag team titles, A, is something I believe should happen anyway, which is, you know, makes me biased towards that. But it feels interesting. And, you know, the post-Mania pay-per-views are some of the worst from anything newsworthy happening. Just like the Fastlane shows were essentially pretty useless because your WrestleMania card was set from Royal Rumble to going into WrestleMania. So if you can put a spotlight on things that don't typically get a spotlight, that is positive, but it's more of a holistic issue I have with WWE, just not having anyone that can legitimately stand a chance against him. And I don't know if I see that changing. Maybe Drew's the person at Money in the Bank, but you know, beyond that, you're kind of running thin on people to throw against him at this point. So I think this will be a conversation throughout the rest of 2022 that we'll be having about Roman and who he'll be facing.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Tyler, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Always a pleasure talking wrestling with you. I'll let you go ahead and plug everything else that you do for the Torch right now and where people can find you on social media.
Very good. So I'll be quick. Obviously, you brought it up at the top of the show. If you missed that, check out our PW Torch YouTube page. We have daily news hits that are about 5 or 6 minutes every day, and then Zach and I do Fireside Chat, which is a long-form conversation show about the hottest topics in wrestling. So please check that out and like and subscribe. And then from the traditional side, I do the AEW Dynamite Alternative Report every Wednesday. And then I also do the AEW Rampage VIP post show with a rotating cast of co-hosts. So you can check me out everywhere there. You can find me on Twitter at Ring of Tyler. And Greg, thank you. As always, it is a pleasure, and I love that I got to talk Impact Wrestling for like 40 minutes. I think that's the longest I've ever talked about Impact on anywhere, and like not being facetious, like I think Impact's important as a brand now, and like as a community, we need to protect it and talk about it a little bit more. So I appreciate you being such on the torch, and from a long-term standpoint, you've always been an advocate for them. So I appreciate you for doing that.
Yeah, you better be careful, because it's always tough to get someone on here to talk Impact with me. So I know Darren Lilly is a guy that I can go to, and he does a great job covering Impact for PWTorch.com, and he's kind of my go-to guy for that. But now that I know you are interested in talking about it, I'll add you to the Impact list. You know, you're the AEW guy now for the Torch, and we didn't really even talk much AEW this week. It does give you an opportunity to kind of branch out and talk about some other things, and we'll have you on another time, I'm sure, to talk extensively about AEW. So I look forward to doing that.
Sounds good.
Absolutely, Tyler Sage. We'll be back next week, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, pwtorchdailycast.com. Get those questions in, wnialivecast@gmail.com. I'll have Frank Pettiani with me here, another member of the Torch family. We will be previewing WrestleMania Backlash. So if you have any questions about that pay-per-view, especially as you're watching Raw and SmackDown this week, as the card starts to take shape and develop, get those questions in, and you can tune in next Sunday night. We're live 8 p.m. Eastern. Call in 515-605-9345 with questions about that show or any of the other big shows coming up in pro wrestling. So look forward to talking to you then. I am Greg Parks. You can find me on Twitter @GregMParks, and we'll talk to you again next Sunday, because if it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America.